thinking about the past few 5 days. She'd been back in Chiraeth for almost a full 5 day, and every one of those days had been an incredible whirl of events. She could scarcely sort them all out in her memory, and she felt relatively certain that several of those memories had gotten themselves arranged out of order. But despite her sense of exhaustion, she'd found herself feeling an enormous relief as well. She'd had her mother's regular letters, of course, and Green Mountains, and Caleb's, for that matter, but that hadn't been the same thing as actually being here. After more than 12 years on the throne, it had seemed unnatural to have to rely on the reports of others, no matter how much she trusted those others. And it had to have seemed even odder to them to have their monarch off living in another kingdom entirely. "I have to admit," she said aloud after a few moments, "that overall, things have worked out even better than I'd hoped they would."
"Aside from any minor plots to murder you, you mean?"
Green Mountain's voice was just a little edgy, and Charlian realized he'd been less calm about the assassination attempt than he tried to pretend. Her eyes softened at the thought, and she smiled at him. "Aside from that, of course," she conceded. "I must say, dear, that however well we might have managed in the long term with you and Telesburg, the decision to come home was a good one," her mother said. Charlian looked at her, and the Queen Mother shrugged. "When word of the attack on St. Agatha's reached us, the public reaction was unhappy."
"As always, your mother is a mistress of understatement," Green Mountain said dryly. "On the plus side, I expect that any of your nobles who may have been feeling restive again about the keenly felt injustice of finding themselves saddled with a mere queen have rethought their positions. Meeting Emperor Caleb face to face would probably have produced much of that effect anyway, of course. While he may not have struck them as a delicious young man, I rather doubt that any of them would like to find him angry at them. And even if they were prepared to risk that, the kingdom's reaction to the attempt on your life should have been sufficient warning for anyone but a complete idiot. Your people haven't forgotten what happened to your father, you know, Your Majesty."
"Neither have I," Charlian said darkly. "No, of course you haven't," Alana said, and her own eyes were hard. "I'm rather looking forward to paying our debt to Hector Dakin. In full, with all deferred interest." "As we all are, Mother," Charlian replied, reminding herself that word of Hector's assassination hadn't yet reached Chisholm. Or rather, it hadn't reached anyone else in Chisholm. That was going to change almost momentarily, of course, but she was beginning to fully appreciate the enormous advantage Merlin Athrawes's visions and the ability to communicate information over vast distances almost instantly truly conferred. "Not to mention the pain in the posterior Caleb must have found it when he couldn't share that sort of information with me."
"The most important thing, aside from the fact that you're still alive, is how well you succeeded in communicating who was truly behind it to everyone here in Chisholm," Green Mountain said.
She looked at him, and he smiled at her approvingly.
"Your mother's right about your decision to come home. No message from you could have been as convincing as actually seeing you here on Chisholmian soil, and it's a very good thing that you arrived so close on the heels of the news itself. Whatever anyone else may say now, for the first 5 day or so there was an enormous amount of suspicion. Halcombe's plan to drive a wedge between Chisholm and Carys almost worked. In fact, if he'd managed to kill you after all, it would have worked."
"I know. I was afraid of that from the very beginning," Charlian admitted. "That's why I waited long enough for Baron Wave Thunder's investigation to confirm at least some of the details. I needed to be able to tell people here who really planned the attack and why, and the price your Carysian guardsmen paid to keep it from succeeding," her mother said softly. "I'll never forget what those men did for you, dear. Neither will I.
Charlian felt her eyes burn once more, and made herself draw another deep breath.
Neither will I, she repeated. But since they did manage to keep me alive, I suppose it's time the three of us got down to work.
Of course, Your Majesty,
Green Mountain said rather more formally, and she smiled at him.
First, Marak, she said, I'd like to discuss your view of the way Uncle Bertram's allies on the Council are most likely to react to all of this. Then I'd like your personal impressions,
and yours, Mother,
on how our own Temple Loyalists are likely to respond. After all, there are a couple of treasury issues I'd promised Baron Ironhill I'd look into. It's past time Caleb and I got a common imperial currency established, and now that we have the Imperial Parliament just about fully organized, we can start thinking about other things.
So, her mother and her first counselor sat back, their expressions intent, as Charlian set briskly to work. Charlian looked up as Edward Seahamper opened the door and cleared his throat politely.
I beg your pardon, Your Majesty, but a courier has just arrived from the Emperor.
He has.
The Empress's eyebrows arched, and Seahamper nodded gravely. Without, she reflected, so much of a flicker of expression to betray the fact that he and Charlian had already known the man was on his way. She smiled mentally at the thought.
At least there's one person I can discuss things like this with without worrying, she told herself. Caleb may have Merlin, but I've got Edward, and that's almost as good.
He says his dispatches are urgent, Your Majesty,
her personal armsman added, and she nodded crisply.
In that case, by all means, admit him at once.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Seahamper withdrew briefly, and Charlian looked around at her mother's and her first counselor's faces. She was a little surprised by how much they'd managed to accomplish since lunch. There was still far more to accomplish, of course. It could scarcely have been any other way after her long absence, but they'd made a sizable dent in the backlog. It was fortunate that so much of it consisted simply of approving and confirming decisions they'd already made.
And the best part of it is that, for all intents and purposes, Mother has been ruling Chisholm in my stead, and there hasn't even been a hiccup. Not on the secular side, at least. Maybe I've actually managed to convince the kingdom that a monarch doesn't have to be male?
Of course, there was always the religious side. The good news there was that between them, Archbishop Powell, Green Mountain, Sir Albert Justin, Chisholm's equivalent of Baron Wave Thunder, and Earl Whitecrag, the kingdom's Lord Justice, had managed to keep their feet firmly on the neck of any Temple Loyalist temptation towards some sort of act of resistance. The fact that it had been Temple Loyalists in Karras who had attempted to murder their queen, and the fashion in which the rest of the kingdom had reacted to that news, had undoubtedly strengthened the inclination for Chisholm's Temple Loyalists to keep their heads down. Unfortunately, that didn't mean they decided to accept Charlian's heretical defiance of Mother Church. Thanks to Merlin and his snarks, Charlian was probably better aware of that even than Justin or Green Mountain, neither of whom cherished any illusions in that respect. In fact, Charlian knew that at least three members of her own council were currently in communication with the deposed Bishop Executor Wushai. At the moment, she and Merlin were both convinced they'd identified the major players, as Merlin described them, but that too had its drawbacks. Knowing who to watch was a priceless advantage. Fighting down the temptation to have them arrested for what she knew they were doing but would find difficult to prove in open court wasn't easy. In fact, she'd found herself sorely tempted to manufacture the evidence she needed. Fortunately, she'd decided long ago that policies like that were what got kings and queens overthrown by their own nobles. the fact that she'd always been scrupulously just in her treatment even of her enemies among the Chisomian nobility was a major factor in the readiness with which the majority of her nobles accepted the justice she handed down when she had clear and compelling evidence of wrongdoing by one of their own number.
"Well, eventually you're going to give me that evidence, my lords, or at least show me where one of my merely mortal agents can discover it. And when that day comes..."
The council chamber door opened once more as Seahamper returned with Caleb's courier.
"Your Majesty..."
The courier, a Chisomian, Charlian noted, said, bowing profoundly. "Your name?" she asked.
"Commander Travia Gowan, Your Majesty."
Gowan smiled, obviously pleased that she'd cared enough to ask.
"I have the honor to command the armed schooner Sentinel."
"Thank you," she said, smiling back at him, then sat back in her chair. "Sergeant Seahamper says your dispatches are urgent, Commander Gowan?"
"I fear they are, Your Majesty."
Gowan's smile had disappeared into a sober expression. "In that case, Commander, may we have them?"
"Of course, Your Majesty."
Gowan opened his dispatch case and extracted a thick envelope, sealed with Caleb's personal seal and addressed to Charlian in Clifford Lyman's clear, strong script. He laid it in her extended hand with another bow. "Thank you," she said once more, weighing it in her palm. "Does your vessel require supplies or service, Commander?"
"I would prefer to take on fresh water before returning to sea, Your Majesty. With that proviso, Sentinel could sail within the hour."
"I don't believe we'll need to pack you back off quite that quickly, Commander Gowan," Charlian said with a smile. "I'm pleased to hear that we could if we had to, but I expect you'll have time for at least a fresh salad and a shore-cooked meal before we send you back to Coruscant."
"Thank you, Your Majesty," Gowan replied, bowing once more as he recognized his dismissal.
Seahamper escorted him back out of the council chamber, and Charlian turned to Green Mountain and her mother. "And now," she said whimsically, her smile crooked as her slender fingers broke the heavy wax seals, "let's see what fresh bad news Coruscant has seen fit to provide us with."
"So, I'm none too sure they believe you."
If any of Empress Charlian's subjects, aside from her personal armsmen, had happened to glance into her bedchamber, they might have had significant reservations about their monarch's stability. She sat in one of the huge, overstuffed chairs, with her feet tucked up under her, speaking to apparently empty air. It was very late, and she'd sent Sarai Hallman off to bed hours ago. Mara Lucas was still recovering from the injury she'd suffered when Bertram Wayston had arranged her riding fall to keep her safely out of the way at St. Agatha's, and getting her to turn in reasonably early hadn't been difficult either. Now Charlian sat in the candlelit bedchamber, watching the silver orb of Langhorne, Safehold's single moon, climbing steadily higher beyond her window, and cocked her head to one side while she listened.
"I wish I could say I was surprised to hear that," Caleb's voice said in her right ear. "Unfortunately, if I were they, I might very well have thought I'd done it too."
"I think they'll come around to accepting the truth eventually," Charlian assured her far-distant husband. "Marak is already more than three-quarters of the way to acknowledging just how remarkably stupid it would have been for you to have Hector killed at this particular time. At the moment, he seems to be torn between admiration for your apparently ruthless pragmatism, wondering just how you could have been dumb enough to do it, and concern over what it says about your character in long-range terms."
"And your mother?"
"Well, Mother already thought you were a delicious young man," Charlian chuckled. "I think she's been both pleased and surprised by how much she likes you. And to be honest, the thought that you might have had Hector murdered after what happened to Father only makes her like you even more."
Frankly, I think she's going to be disappointed when she finally realizes you really, really didn't do it.
I suppose that's better than having her running in horror from the cold-blooded murderer who could do such a thing, Caleb said dryly.
Trust me, Caleb. The only thing that could have made Mother love you more than the notion that you'd collected Hector's head would be the birth of her first grandchild. Which, by the way, she mentioned rather pointedly to me this afternoon. She seems to be of the opinion that having you in Coruscant and me in Karras or Chisholm isn't very likely to provide for the succession. A thought which has also occurred to me, if not for such purely pragmatic reasons.
You're not the only two people it's occurred to, Caleb said with feeling. And, as you say, not necessarily for purely pragmatic reasons.
So just when are you going to darken my doorway so we can begin working on this little problem?
Charlene asked, and her own tone was rather pointed, Caleb noticed.
Soon, I think, he replied more seriously. This afternoon I met with Tartarian and Anvil Rock for the fifth time. There were a couple of points they wanted to talk about, but they obviously realized they have no choice but to sign on the dotted line in the end. They're going to, Charlene, and as soon as they do, I'm installing General Cherman down here as my interim viceroy, and Empress of Karras and I are setting sail for Cherry Bay.
Good.
The only question in my mind is how I'm going to be greeted when I arrive, Caleb continued.
If you mean here in the palace, I don't think anyone could care less either way, whether or not you had Hector murdered, Charlene replied.
Oh, some people are going to be worried about it, and still more are probably going to pretend to be horrified by the very notion. But the truth is that everybody knows Hector would have had you and your father assassinated in a moment if he'd thought he could get away with it. In fact, I'd estimate that half the nobles in Chisholm think he was involved in Tyrion's assassination plot, whatever Narmon or you might have to say about it. And the possibility that you did order it is working in our favor in some ways. I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find out Merlin Snarks are reporting that the members of the nobility most likely to conspire against us with the Temple Loyalists are re-evaluating their positions in light of the belief that you'll simply have them killed if they turn into too much of a problem.
Wonderful. Charlene's imagination could almost literally see Caleb rolling his eyes.
Who was that old earth political writer you mentioned to me the other day, Merlin?
Machiavelli, Merlin replied.
His voice was even clearer than Caleb's, and that, Charlene realized, was because it was being transmitted directly from Merlin's built-in communicator.
That was the one, Caleb agreed. I guess I'm going to find out whether he was right about its being better to be feared than to be loved, he sighed. Well, Father always said it was essential that your enemies fear you. I'm not too sure I like the notion of being feared by my own subjects, though.
I think you only have to worry about that where the nobility is concerned, Charlene said reassuringly. The common folk are even more inclined to think you had Hector killed. The difference between them and the nobility is that they don't have any reservations about it, if you did. In fact, they've been lighting bonfires to celebrate Hector's death, and in salute to you for having brought it about, ever since the news broke. I have mentioned that Hector wasn't very popular here in Chisholm, haven't I?
Once or twice, I suppose, Caleb conceded.
Well, there you have it, Charlene shrugged. We can't do anything about the way the church is going to use this for propaganda. And Narmon and Merlin are both right. Even if the church, or Clinton at least, didn't actually order the murders, they're still going to use what happened as a hammer to beat both of us with. But as far as our own people are concerned, even if we did it, it's perfectly all right with them. As a matter of fact, some of them actually seem to regard it as a sort of appropriate vengeance for Halcombe's attempt to murder me.
What?
Charlian heard the confusion in his voice and giggled.
Of course it is silly.
I know we've officially exonerated Hector of any involvement in Halcombe's plot, but there's no way my people are going to give up a perfectly good conspiracy theory.
Wonderful, Caleb said again, his tone more than moderately disgusted. If they all believe it, then it's going to be damned hard to convince anyone else of the truth.
We'll just have to do the best we can. And in the meantime, getting you back here to Chisholm to spend a few months with both of us in residence, like the Empire's constitution requires, if memory serves, should pretty much finish cementing Chisholm's acceptance of the new political arrangements. Of course, she smiled wickedly out the window. That's going to mean you get to spend the winter here in Chisholm. We have this thing here that you may not have seen in Caris. It's called snow.
I have heard of the phenomenon, Caleb told her with dignity. But surely you don't mean to say it's so cold in Chisholm that it actually sticks to the ground without melting, do you?
It has been known to happen, she assured him solemnly.
Well, in that case, from now on we're spending the winters in Caris.
That would be my choice too, all things considered together. Or maybe not. Not at the moment, at any rate.
Why not?
He tried to keep his tone light, but she heard the sudden spike of worry in its depths, and smiled again.
Don't worry. It's not because I mistrust our Carisians any more than I mistrust our Chisomians. It's just that it's just occurred to me that it is going to be cold here in Chiraeth, isn't it?
And? Caleb asked with suspicious caution.
Well, if it's really cold, then a poor thin-blooded southern boy such as yourself is going to be looking for any source of warmth he can find.
And? Caleb repeated.
And, she said sweetly, right off the top of my head, I can't think of anything much warmer than a nice big bed right here in the palace, with big thick quilts and comforters. If we manage it right, we might not have to come out at all before spring.
September, Year of God 893. 1. The Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands.
We spend too much time in council chambers like this,
Robert Ducairne thought.
For that matter, we spend too much time inside the temple, and too little time out in God's world. We're too busy enjoying the luxury of the temple to appreciate the rest of the world the archangels built for us, and the one everyone else has no choice but to live in all year round.
It was a thought which had occurred to him with increasing frequency over the last year or two, and he'd made an effort to do something about it. Yet, however hard he tried, the responsibilities of his offices and the deepening dangers and challenges which confronted the church on every hand kept drawing him back.
It's going to be even worse once winter settles in again, he warned himself. Once the snow gets deep enough, once it gets cold enough out there, you're going to find even more reasons to stay comfortably inside, insulated from all that unpleasantness.
There was a metaphor in that, he thought, and not one that had anything to do with weather. He looked up as Zomson Trenaire came through the door. The Chancellor was running late, the last of the group of four to arrive, and he gave them a brief, tight smile of apology.
Forgive me, brothers, he said. My office had just received a dispatch from Desnaire, and I thought it best to have it deciphered before I came.
And did it say anything interesting?
Jaspar Clinton growled from his place at the council table.
There were some interesting observations in it, Trenaire replied. Nothing particularly earth-shattering. Most of it consisted of second-hand reports on what the Carisians have been doing to completely finish off Delphirax shipping. Apparently, their Admiral Rockpoint has begun sending cutting-out expeditions even into neutral ports now, in broad daylight, as often as not, to take out or burn any Delphirock-flagged ship. I've had copies made for all of us, especially for you, Elaine.
Elaine Magwer nodded in thanks, although the gratitude in his expression was scarcely unalloyed. He'd become painfully aware that his was the most precarious position of any of the group of four, despite the fact that officially it was he who had realized the Church was going to require a navy of galleons, not galleys. The fact remained that no one, with the possible exception of Duquesne, could really count the number of marks which had been poured into their useless galley fleet first. And there were persistent rumors that it was actually Clinton who had recognized Magwer's initial mistake. Rumors, Magwer strongly suspected, which had originated with the Grand Inquisitor himself, and which carried with them a damnation of Magwer's own judgment, which was, unfortunately, only too accurate in this instance.
"Was there anything more about Hector's assassination?" Clinton asked.
"Only about the rumors and speculations swirling around in Desnaire," Trenair said.
He looked at Clinton with carefully concealed speculation.
"I haven't had any new reports about the actual event, have you?"
"No,"
Clinton shook his head.
"If I had, I would certainly have brought them to everyone's attention."
Everyone in this case meant the other members of the group of four, of course, Duquesne thought sourly.
"I wish we did have more reliable information about it," he said aloud, watching Clinton's expression from behind outwardly calm eyes. "That whole affair still seems odd to me."
"What's odd about it?"
Clinton snorted disdainfully.
"Caleb obviously had the man killed. He had reasons enough, as far as he was concerned, even before he married Charlian. And the entire world knows how much that bitch hated Hector."
Something about Clinton's dismissive, almost casual assignment of guilt clicked down inside Robert Duquesne. The Treasurer General's eyes flicked sideways to Trenaire's, and saw the same realization there. Both of them, Duquesne knew, had wondered from the outset. Now they knew.
"Yes, well," Trenaire said, "whoever arranged it."
He was very carefully not looking in Clinton's direction, Duquesne realized.
"It leaves us with some interesting dilemmas."
"We've had enough of those for the last couple of years," Clinton observed. "I don't see how a few more are going to make all that much difference."
"I hope you'll forgive me, Jaspar," Trenaire said with just a hint of asperity. "But quite a few of these dilemmas are going to fall into the political arena. That makes them of rather more than passing interest to me and to my office. And, I would have thought, they'll undoubtedly have implications for the Inquisition as well."
Clinton's jowly face tightened for just an instant, but then it smoothed again, and he nodded.
"You're right,"
he conceded, which was about as close to an apology as he ever came.
"Thank you."
Trenaire settled into his place at the head of the table and looked around at the other three faces.
"At the moment, of course, as we're all well aware, all of our information on Hector's murder is fragmentary and second-hand at best. I'm sure we all hope we're going to get more reliable reports, from Bishop Executor Thomas, preferably, soon. On the other hand, it's already September. It's not going to be many more 5 days before the weather begins closing down our ability to send and receive messages, even with the semaphore. I think we're going to have to go ahead and decide how to begin responding to this with the information we already have, however unsatisfactory it may be in some respects."
"Obviously, the first thing to do," Clinton said, "is to condemn the bloody actions of Caleb, Charlian, and the rest of the apostate leadership." I realize Hector and his son were only two more lives against all of the thousands who have already died because of their defiance of Mother Church. But if they're prepared to murder reigning princes and their heirs this casually, it indicates an entirely new level of danger.
In what way, Jaspar? Ducairne asked. He was actually a bit surprised he'd been able to keep his tone so neutral.
The sheer brazenness of it, for one thing, Clinton replied. The fact that they're willing to murder their opponents so openly only underscores their contempt for the rest of the world's judgment and condemnation. And, of course, it's going to have implications for other princes and kings, isn't it? Who can ever be certain a Carizian assassin isn't stalking them, if they appear to be some sort of obstacle to Caleb's and Charlian's obscene ambition? Besides, we're talking about an act of murder, Robert. The murder of not just anyone, but of a prince consecrated by Mother Church herself, and one who was waging God's own fight against the forces of apostasy. I realize they've already demonstrated in Farade that they were willing to murder even priests of God, but now they've proven they'll murder anyone, and without even the benefit of a show trial like the one in Farade. Hector's a martyr, yet another martyr in the holy war against Caris and the forces of darkness. We owe it to his memory, to God, and to Mother Church, to make that clear to every member of the faithful.
I see. Ducairne managed to keep his gorge down, although it wasn't easy. The fervor shining in Clinton's eyes frightened him. It was almost as if the Grand Inquisitor actually believed what he was saying about Caris's responsibility for Hector's death. The fact that he could first order an act of murder so casually, and then exploit it so cynically, was bad enough. The possibility that he was actually able to believe his own lies was far worse, especially in one who wielded the authority of the Inquisition.
"I think we can all agree with that, Jaspar," Trinair said calmly. "As you say, however Hector died, on the field of battle, in bed, or struck down by an assassin's hand, he was obviously waging war against Mother Church's enemies. While I would never wish to appear overly cynical or calculating," Ducairne wondered if he was the only one who noticed how Trinair's eyes hardened ever so briefly as the Chancellor gazed at Clinton. "The simple propaganda value of making that point publicly and loudly will be invaluable."
"I thought so myself,"
Clinton agreed with the merest hint of complacency. Magwer looked up sharply, and Ducairne felt something almost like pity for the Captain General.
"Just waking up to it now, are you, Alain?"
he thought sardonically.
"Well, better late than never, I suppose. But you'll really need to work on controlling your expression."
From the look in Magwer's eyes, he'd finally realized what Trinair and Ducairne had suspected all along, and the fact that Clinton had acted unilaterally, without even consulting his colleagues, must be even more frightening to him than it was to Ducairne. After all, Magwer was the most vulnerable of the group of four. The rest of the vicarate had been unhappy, to put it mildly, when the entire new galley fleet was declared obsolete before its very first battle against the forces of darkness. Even those too circumspect, or terrified, to openly criticize the Grand Inquisitor or the Chancellor, were beginning to mutter about the Captain General's apparent incompetence. Now, Clinton had thrown Hector casually to the Slash Lizards, simply because the man was more valuable as a suitably deceased martyr than he was alive. If the Grand Inquisitor could do that, then he could certainly offer up the weakest and most vulnerable of his colleagues to appease the rest of the Vicarate's wrath.
"And he will do it, Alain," Ducairne thought, "without a moment's hesitation or a single second thought, if he sees any advantage in it."
An image came to him, an image of ice wyverns on an island of drift ice, pushing one of their fellows into the water to see if the krakens were still there. It wasn't very difficult to imagine one of them with Magwer's face.
"One of the dilemmas I mentioned a moment ago," Trenaire continued, "is what we do about Prince Divin, however."
"I'm not sure there's any reason to rush into decisions where he's concerned, Zomsen," Ducairne said.
The Chancellor looked at him, one eyebrow raised, and he shrugged.
"At the moment, he and his sister, and the Earl of Corris, are safe enough in Tel'Kyra."
"And at the moment, James has every reason to keep him there, too,"
Clinton said with a deep, amused chuckle. However little Ducairne might care for Clinton's amusement over the war between Delphiroc and Karras, which had emerged from the Grand Inquisitor's own ship seizure policy, he had to concede that Clinton had a point. As long as King James was at war with Caleb and Charlian, he was scarcely likely to surrender his wife's distant cousin to the Carisians.
"And at least Tal'Kyra's far enough inland that the Carisians can't get to it," Ducairne thought caustically. "They seem to be able to go anywhere else in his kingdom they choose to."
He upbraided himself. It wasn't King James's fault that the Imperial Carisian Navy could land marines at any point along his coast it chose. It was obvious the Carisians realized there was nothing he could do about it, though, and they were deliberately and methodically shutting down every port and harbor Delphiroc had once boasted. They hadn't burned any more cities, but their blockade was virtually impenetrable, and they'd continued pouncing on every military target that offered itself. By now, the Delphirocan navy was extinct, and although the Carisians had been scrupulously careful to avoid collateral damage to non-Delphirocan property in the course of their cutting-out expeditions to seize Delphirocan merchant ships and galleys in neutral ports, no one really wanted to risk Caleb's ire by offering those Delphirocan vessels refuge. Still, there was a lot of validity to Ducairne's own thought about the security of James II's capital city. Tal'Kyra truly was much too far inland to be effectively threatened by any Carisian attack, which, in its own way, summed up the ultimate limitations upon Carisian power. Despite their successes along Delphirock's coast, or their ability to invade Coruscant, or even the confusing, fragmentary reports Magwer had so far received about their marines' frightening new weapons and tactics, they simply lacked the land-based manpower to fight their way into the vitals of any mainland realm.
"I'm not especially concerned about Divin's physical security or safety," Trenaire said. "I'm concerned about his political value. I'd prefer to see to it that no one else tries to exploit that value in a way which might conflict with our own policies."
"Leave the boy be for now, Zomsen,"
Clinton said almost impatiently.
"He's not going anywhere. Where could he go, after all? No one who isn't already actively fighting the apostates is going to want to risk fishing in waters like these, at least until we tell them to. And when the time comes that we need him, we'll be able to put our hand on him whenever we choose."
"It's not quite that simple, Jaspar. Especially not if we intend to recognize him as the rightful Prince of Coruscant."
"Actually, I think Jaspar is right," Ducairne said,
little though he relished finding himself in agreement with the Grand Inquisitor. Trenaire looked at him again, and Ducairne shrugged.
"It's not as if Divin, or Corus, who's the one who really matters in this instance, has anyone else to champion his cause. If we proclaim that Divin is the legitimate Prince of Coruscant, and if Mother Church undertakes to restore him to his throne when the schism has been utterly defeated, that ought to be enough. Certainly Corus is smart enough and experienced enough to realize that. Let's leave him where he is, for now at least. We can handle anything we need to handle through correspondence. Or, for that matter, we can always summon Corus here to Zion for us to give him more specific face-to-face instructions. I think we can let a barely 9-year-old boy who's just been orphaned try to find some stability in his life before we drag him into some sort of political frying pan.
Trenaire gazed into Ducairn's eyes for several moments, then nodded slowly. Ducairn was in no doubt that Trenaire would sacrifice the boy without a moment's hesitation if he decided it was the expedient thing to do. But at least the Chancellor had enough compassion to be willing to let a grieving boy be until it became the expedient thing to do. It was possible Clinton did too, but Ducairn personally never doubted that Clinton's position was the result of indifference, or even of smug satisfaction with how well his murder of the boy's father had worked out, rather than of any sort of concern for young Divin.
"All right," Trenaire said aloud. "I'll draft a message to Corus embodying our recognition of Divin and suggesting ways in which Corus and the Prince might be of assistance to us against his father's killers. I'll circulate the draft to all of you before I send it, of course," he added with a slightly pointed glance in Clinton's direction.
That glance bounced off of the Grand Inquisitor's armor without so much as scratching its paint.
"In the meantime," Magware put in, "I have to admit that I'm a bit concerned over the fact that, as Zomson pointed out earlier, the weather is going to greatly impede our ability to communicate in another few 5 days."
"Concerned in what way?" Ducairn asked.
"I'm not that worried about our ability to coordinate our plans elsewhere," Magware said. "Our existing instructions are comprehensive enough that they probably aren't going to need a lot of modifications. And I think we're all agreed that it's unlikely, to say the least, that the apostates are going to attempt any major operations against the mainland until next spring. So it's unlikely we're going to have to respond to any immediate military crises."
"Any more immediate military crises, you mean?"
Clinton muttered, in a voice whose level was carefully calculated to be just audible. Magware's lips tightened for a moment, but he continued as if the Grand Inquisitor hadn't spoken.
"What does worry me," he said, "is what's going to happen here, in the Temple and in Zion, once winter really closes in. There's always that tendency to turn inward after the first heavy snowfall."
What might almost have been unwilling and surprised respect flickered in Clinton's eyes, and Ducairn found himself sharing the Grand Inquisitor's surprise. One didn't normally expect that sort of remark out of Elaine Magware. Although, the Treasurer General thought a moment later, Magware's awareness of his own weakened position might just explain it. As Magware had so aptly pointed out, once winter closed in around the city of Zion, the temple's interests tended to switch to more purely internal matters. Communications with the outside world were slowed, less reliable, and the rhythm of Mother Church's life slowed with them. Vicars and archbishops resident in Zion tended to use that time to polish up their alliances and catch up on paperwork and routine administrative matters. And animosities and pet grievances with one another tended to loom even larger than usual within the hierarchy's rival factions. But this winter was going to be different. This winter was going to be spent worrying, reflecting upon Grand Vicar Eric's address from the throne, and thinking about the implications for the future. Karras's apparently unbroken string of triumphs was going to be a huge factor in that thinking, and so were any potential criticisms of the Group of Four's leadership. The normally somnolent winter was going to be anything but tranquil, with potentially dire consequences for the Group of Four. Or, at least, for its most vulnerable member.
Oh, I think we'll find something to keep us busy,
Clinton said, and something about his tone snatched Ducairne's attention back to him. The light in Clinton's eyes wasn't simply confident, it was anticipatory. The light of a man looking greedily forward to some treat he'd promised himself. Tiny, icy feet seemed to dance up and down inside Ducairne's bones. Was it possible that...
Do you have some particular something in mind, Jaspar?
Trenaire asked. From the Chancellor's expression, he seemed to have noticed the same thing, but he asked his question rather more calmly than Ducairne thought he could have asked it.
Something always comes along, Zamson,
Clinton pointed out almost jovially.
In fact, I've noticed that it tends to come along at the most surprisingly useful times.
Ducairne's stomach muscles tightened as he recalled a seemingly innocent conversation with Vicar Samuel Wilson. He hadn't really thought all that deeply about it at the time, mostly because it had seemed so appropriate to the moment. Since he'd been called to the Orange, Ducairne had missed altogether too many of the retreats to which he'd been routinely invited. He'd been trying to make up for some of that, as much as he could fit it into his schedule's voracious demands at any rate. And he'd found himself sitting next to Wilson at one of the prayer breakfasts he'd attended. He hadn't given much thought to the coincidence which had brought them together. Not then. Not until later, when he'd had the opportunity to reflect on possibly deeper meanings in what Wilson had said. He'd had two or three more conversations, brief to be sure, with Wilson since. All of them, like the first one, could have been nothing more than innocent coincidences, but Ducairne didn't believe that for a moment. Wilson had been sounding him out about something, and given the Wilson family's well-earned reputation, it wouldn't have been something of which Clinton would have approved. If Wilson's really up to something, and if Jaspar's gotten wind of it... Ducairne hadn't worked with Clinton for so many years without realizing how the Grand Inquisitor's mind worked. The possible opportunity to finally crush his most hated rival would appeal strongly to him at any time. And he'd take special pleasure in waiting until he could use the chance to condemn Wilson for treason against Mother Church, to divert his colleague's attention from the Group of Four's failures at the most opportune possible time. Even better, from his perspective at least, the discovery of traitors within the ranks of the vicarate itself could only help to whip up even more fervor against all of the Church's enemies, and strengthen Clinton's hand as the man charged with rooting out those enemies wherever they might hide. Even if that meant among his fellow vicars, and especially among the ones who might have dared to criticize the Grand Inquisitor and his allies for mismanagement of the schism. Trenaire hadn't had the advantage of Ducairne's exchanges with Wilson, but he, too, obviously sensed something else under Clinton's surface joviality. Whatever he might suspect, however, he clearly wasn't prepared to press the point at the moment. At any rate, he said, brushing Clinton's remarks aside, as if they truly were as innocuous as Clinton had implied, there are several more points I'd like to discuss this afternoon. First, there's the matter of the fashion in which Siddharmark appears to be conspiring to continue trading with Karis. Siddharmark isn't the only place where it's happening either, I'm afraid. As Robert warned us, men who face ruin as the economic consequences of the embargo begin to bite are prone to seek solutions to their difficulties. It occurs to me that it would be unreasonable to expect anything else, which means... He continued speaking, dealing with the day-to-day business of administering Mother Church in such troubled times, but Robert Ducairne discovered that he was listening with only half an ear. The rest of his attention was focused someplace else,
worrying about something entirely different.
2. Royal Palace, City of Chiraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm.
There. See what I mean about nice warm beds? The Empress of Karas demanded, as she snuggled close to the Emperor and laid her head on his chest.
I'm sure it will be a nice warm bed one of these nights, he replied, in the tone of a man clearly giving such weighty matters the due consideration they deserved, as he draped an arm across her back and his palm settled against damp, sweet-smelling skin.
At the moment, however, I can't really say that the air temperature is all that frigid, even here in far northern Chisholm.
He gave an exaggerated shiver, and Charlian chuckled. If pressed, she would have been forced to concede that she'd been guilty, during her months in Telesburg, of just a little exaggeration where the iciness of Chiraeth's climate was concerned. She supposed she really shouldn't have been, but it had proved impossible for her to resist the temptation to play to her Carizian audience's apparent expectations. From the wide-eyed credulity with which they had absorbed her tales, she was sure most of them were convinced Chisholmians spent the entire winter bundled to the eyebrows in furs and parkas. Actually, she knew the September night really was a bit on the cool side for Caleb's Carizian sensibilities. It was going to get much worse than that by the time winter closed in, and she knew that too. Just as she knew that during Caleb's career in the Royal Carizian Navy, his ship had sailed through waters as bitterly cold as anything he was going to face here in Chiraeth.
Which doesn't make it one bit less satisfying to tease him about it, she admitted to herself. Besides, we are both going to treasure the warmth of our bed before the ice melts in the spring.
Actually, Caleb said, his breath soft and warm on her ear, I'm prepared to concede, not in front of witnesses, mind you, but solely in private, that this particular bed has quite a few things to recommend it.
Indeed, she pushed up on one elbow to look into his eyes. And what, pray tell, might those few things be?
Well, he replied judiciously, reaching up with one finger to draw gentle circles around one of her nipples. First, it's big enough. I can't begin to count the number of beds I've seen which were just plain too short. Your feet hang off at one end, or your head hangs off at the other. And it's well stuffed, too. That's always an important feature. Sometimes mattresses get stuffed with straw, or even old corn husks, and that's never very pleasant. The sheets are nice, too, now that I think about it, and the embroidery on the pillowcases is first rate. Not quite up to Carizian standards, perhaps, but considering the limitations available to the decorator, quite satisfactory. Then there's... He broke off as his wife took shameless advantage of his own currently nude state. Now, now, he said hastily, as her grip tightened. Let's not do anything we'll both regret.
Oh, I'm not going to do anything I'll regret, she assured him with a wicked smile.
Well, in that case, I suppose I should also add that the most important feature of this entire bed is that I'm not alone in it, he said.
That's headed in the right direction, she said. Not quite up to Chisholmian standards, perhaps, but considering the limitations available to the speaker, almost satisfactory.
Only almost, he demanded indignantly.
I am the one in position to be pressing my legitimate demands at the moment, among other things, she pointed out sweetly.
Oh, all right. He grinned hugely, gathering her into his arms and sliding her body up and across onto his own. I suppose I might as well go ahead and admit that this is the second nicest bed I've ever been in my entire life. I trust you'll forgive me if I always have a special warm spot for our bed back in Telesburg.
Oh, she kissed him slowly and thoroughly. I suppose I can forgive you for that. After all, so do I.
Some hours later, the two of them sat side by side in the sitting room of their suite, gazing out the windows at the polished silver disk of the moon riding across a sky of blue-black velvet. Stars twinkled, and Caleb shook his head slowly.
Hard to believe that every one of those stars is as big and bright as our own sun, he murmured.
Harder to believe than to believe that Merlin is a 900-year-old woman? Charlian demanded, resting her head on his shoulder.
Yes, actually, Caleb smiled. After all, I can always just fall back on the notion that Merlin really is magic, whatever he says.
Idiot, she said fondly, reaching up to yank on his now fully established beard.
Do you like it? He asked.
She looked up at him and he shrugged.
The beard, I mean. Do you like it?
It tickles in some fairly inappropriate places, she said severely. And I wouldn't want it to get out of hand. No great shaggy clouds of whiskers, you understand. But with that proviso, I guess I can stand it.
Now there's a ringing endorsement, if I ever heard one, he said wryly.
Well, it's going to take some getting used to, she pointed out.
Almost as much as getting used to the notion that Coruscant is now part of the Carizian Empire? He asked, his expression turning rather more serious.
I suppose that depends in the end on just how thoroughly Coruscant is part of the Empire, she said, her own expression matching his. At the moment, the jury is rather still out on that, after all.
That's true enough, he agreed. The good news is that I think Tartarian and Anvil Rock are genuinely convinced now that I didn't order Hector's assassination. Mind you, I don't think Anvil Rock wanted to be convinced, but the man's got a fairly substantial streak of integrity, and his son worked hard on bringing him around.
So you're convinced that they intend to abide by the terms of the peace settlement?
Merlin's shown you the same imagery from his snarks that he's shown me, love. That means your guess is as good as mine. At the moment, though, I'd have to say I think the answer is yes. I don't think they like it. For that matter, if I were in their boots, I wouldn't like it either. But they're smart enough to recognize the inevitable when they see it.
The fact that you guaranteed Divan's personal safety, whether he got to retain his throne or not, didn't hurt, Charlian said shrewdly.
Maybe not, but it wouldn't have helped either if they hadn't decided they can trust me to keep my word as long as they keep theirs. And whatever they may think or intend where the peace settlement is concerned, they and the rest of the council are on the back of a particularly irritated slash lizard at the moment. No matter what happens, they're going to be in for a rough ride, and there's a limited amount we can do to help without actually making things worse.
Charlian nodded soberly. One of the main reasons Caleb had returned to Chiraeth was to give Sir Corin Garvai, Tartarian, Anvil Rock, and the remainder of the Coruscantian Council, which was technically acting jointly as Prince Divan's regent, the opportunity to restore and maintain order in Coruscant without his own disturbing presence for the Temple Loyalists and their Coruscantian Patriot allies to rally opposition around. He'd left enough Marines under General Cherman's command, as the official Imperial Viceroy of the new province of Coruscant, to keep a lid on things, at least in the city and Duchy of Manchir, even if worse came to worst, but that was definitely not the way he or Charlian wanted to establish their rule in Coruscant.
There are going to be some rebellions, Caleb, Charlian said after a moment. You know that, don't you? Yes, he sighed. That's inevitable, given the fact that we conquered Coruscant by force of arms rather than through a mutual accommodation like Emeralds, or even Zebediah's for that matter. There's going to be someone who's going to try to throw the foreigners out, whether it's because of genuine patriotism
or as a means to seek personal power for himself. And the religious aspect is only going to make that even worse. I'm not cherishing any rosy illusions about how docile and sweet-natured our new Coruscantian subjects are going to be, Charlie. But at least Tartarian and the Garvais want to limit Coruscantian bloodshed as much as they can. And they know that, ultimately,